You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 222 is Amy Rigby, and you can hear all about her early life in her memoir podcast, Girl to City. Her musical life really started when she moved to New York City, fell in love with the punk scene in the late 70s and early 80s, played briefly with a punk band, but then with her brother Michael was in a band called Last Roundup that released an album in 87. The genre is generally called cowpunk, and recorded a whole other album that didn't get released. She was not the singer in that band, was not confident enough about her voice, and she and her fellow backing vocalists in Last Roundup started a band called The Shams, a sort of Andrew Sisters thing. They released an album and an EP around 93, 94. You're right now hearing Dark Angel by The Shams from that album, Quilt. She finally became the full lead singer, only as a solo artist, starting in 1997 with Diary of a Mod Housewife. She's since released 9 solo albums, the first couple with Elliot Easton, guitarist for The Cars, producing. She had been married to Will Rigby from the DBs that broke up around when she started her solo career. With the new millennium, she paired up with Reckless Eric, whom I've had on the show, who has been the engineer for her recent solo work, and they also recorded 3 albums as a duo. We're going to discuss Bricks from her brand new album, Hang In There With Me, then Genevieve's Bag from the last Amy Rigby Reckless Eric album, A Working Museum from 2012, and then go back to Beer and Kisses from her debut album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, 1997, which also features another person I've had on the show, John Wesley Harding, a.k.a. Wesley Stace. We'll conclude by listening to Dancing with Joey Ramone from her solo album, Little Fugitive, from 2005. For more information, please see amyrigby.com. For more about this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort and get my detailed notes for every episode, see patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will play a little bit of Dark Angel by The Shams from Quilt 1993 to warm us up. You had a couple charges, first with Last Roundup and then with this, before you emerged as a solo artist, and I will refer folks to your extensive podcast / autobiography where they can hear every step of that way, 20 steps. Yeah, we're going to get pretty quickly to the new stuff. I think it was interesting to play a little of Dark Angel before turning to Bricks, was the one, the single from Hang In There With Me, the album that's coming out right now. Can you say anything about this without sketching out the whole journey, where you're at stylistically? I mean, Dark Angel, you were with The Shams and the previous bands and your early solo stuff, you were very into country. We'll talk about that a little later. Dark Angel has a little bit of a quirky, birdsy, thick chord progression, whereas by the time you get to Bricks, like, Eric has the same thing going where you could just play a very simple chord progression and just repeat that. And like, that's the song. I'm putting it up front. I don't have to, before the lyrics come in. Yeah, can you say a little about your change in approach, if you can generalize, before we hear the first song, and tell us where you're at with this new album?
Dark Angel, in some ways, I wish I could go back to that beginner kind of mind that I had when I wrote that song. Musically, didn't know what the hell I was doing and just wasn't even sure what key the song was in and how I got from point A to point B. I think song structure was always just something that I had. Like, I had it in me, you know, what a verse and chorus. I think I'd listened to so much pop music and rock music and country that I kind of, those things were ingrained, but I really like the oddness of that song. But yeah, I think Bricks, maybe as I went along, I got more open to just thematically or lyrically, just kind of going for broke, not really caring or feeling constrained that I was like trying to be commercial or trying to be in a certain genre or anything. So I think the freedom of like being a beginner went away, but I think I became more free as an artist as I gained more confidence, probably.
I can't believe you're back again. I'll tell you now, like I told you then, we're through. Time, we had our fun, put a fork in us, there's no more me and you. You're looking like you've still got plans, but God laughs at a hopeful man. Believe me, and I won't repeat. blinders on, I'm chilling here, but I admit I shed a tear or two. That was then, and this is now, and folks stopped asking what happened to you. Sometimes it's like you're still around, especially when the rain comes down. The earth reveals all that is hid, and I remember what I did. I didn't know I was so strong. You might say things went kinda wrong, but a woman's gotta save herself, and that's what it took. And these bricks won't lay themselves. These bricks won't lay themselves. Dig it. These bricks won't lay themselves. These bricks won't lay themselves.
Thematically, having just experienced your autobiography, is bricks an imaginative, or it seems like it could be based on that same character that's in Dark Angel, that
like a bad guy.
Yes, there's a place in your book where you talk about this fellow showing up after a long time, and you've had a kid at this point, and your brief interaction there. You had mentioned also in your book about how sort of the line between that you think you're writing story songs, but everybody's interpreting them as autobiographical or something. Where does bricks lie in this?
Bricks comes from a song prompt at a songwriting camp I've been to a couple times as an instructor in Michigan. And the guy who runs it, John Lamb is his name, and he writes these very detailed song prompts. He kind of tailors each one to each person at the camp. The song I wrote called From Philip Roth at Gmail to R. Zimmerman at AOL.com from the old guys, that was from one of his song prompts because he knew I was a big Dylan fan. The theme for all the campers was DIY, and pretty much everyone's song prompt started at Lowe's or Home Depot with someone having to like retrieve some kind of item. And mine was literally was bricks. Was the character that I'm writing about real? Yes, but it was also kind of like fiction, and that I pictured this woman who had to complete this job that her ex had started, and she just had to finish it up herself. But it was a really good way to revisit some kind of traumatic relationship that I had way, way long after that bad boyfriend in Dark Angel. It was refreshing to look at something like so much in retrospect. I felt free to just bury the guy under the ground and put the bricks on top of him.
That's interesting. Yeah, because the bricks part is sort of the least definite in terms of the story. Like I was picturing, you know, another brick in the wall sort of thing, or just sort of, I'm trying to establish my life in general, not necessarily that this is somebody that started it with you and you're trying to finish the job, but this is a thing that I'm doing. You have nothing to do with it. Screw off. There's no indication like that he helped you.
That was in the prompt, and I kind of don't. You're right. I didn't. He really was not involved in the DIY project at all. So I, as with any prompt, I, you know, take license. And it was kind of like, oh, you left me with this job to finish and I'm going to do it. I kind of just dumped that out of it and liked the idea of this person just on their own doing this project that maybe might seem like a little too beyond them, but that they were just going to like have this much energy that they were going to see it through. And it also served another purpose because they could kind of bury the past with this laying down this patio. And it was a good way to like kill somebody off, basically.
At what point did this main acoustic guitar chord theme come in? So do you have this going through your head as you're writing the rest of the lyrics, or the lyrics are just on the page and then you pick up a guitar? What's the order of operations?
It always comes all at once, unless I'm driving and get lyrics and kind of write them and get sort of like a melody. And then I obviously have to add the guitar later, kind of find some chords. But in this case, I went back to my room at the camp and just picked up my guitar. And maybe as often as the case, depending what I was listening to at the time, maybe as I was driving out to Michigan, I listened to some country radio. I sometimes do listen to modern country, still find occasional songs that like make me smile or where I enjoy like the clever wordplay. So yeah, I just started playing that figure and just wrote out these words. Can't believe you're back again. I'll tell you now, like I told you then, we're through. And, you know, just kind of within, probably it took me probably about 4 minutes. As is often the case, I had to spend more time on the bridge. Mm-hmm. Bridges for me are always much more like a considered thing that I'll look for a different music feeling, some different chords, and also a different part of the story, more reflective voice maybe. But as for like the verses and the story unfolding, that all just popped out as it is. And it felt very satisfying.
Sure. Sort of what I was referring to before we played the song, this very catchy but very simple intro. This is the chorus. Your chorus is really sort of a pre-chorus, or it almost sounds like it could be a bridge. You know, this horn thing or synth horn thing that's sort of building you up. And we don't get to that the chorus is just you repeating the line, you know, but over the thing that's in the intro. And even though it's very catchy, like you've been writing songs for a long time. I'm sure you've used that progression or something like it before. What makes you like, this is a song? Is it just that you're already working with the lyrics, so you're not overthinking the chords?
Yeah, it's interesting. In that kind of energy of those particular chords played in that song, I don't think I've ever written a song with that progression like that. So it definitely feels very much like that song to me. And I don't worry that I'm repeating myself or you know, did someone use these chords before? You'd never write a song if you thought like, has this been done before? I mean, there's another song on my new album, Hang In There With Me. There's a song called Bangs. And I definitely looked up after I'd written it. I wonder if anyone else has like said, give me bangs or I need bangs in a song. And I found a young male kind of like rapper guy who had a similar, I thought his song was great. I was glad I didn't know it and I didn't like look for it until I was finished. And then I was like, yeah, it's just better to know these things. I don't know that many people have heard his, but it was like, I got motherfucking bangs. You know, but it was sort of, it was a little bit of a male, you know, I felt like he had a similar take on the subject that they gave him this new, he broke up with someone, which wasn't my story in my song, but that he'd broken up with someone and that having this haircut gave him this confidence that he didn't have before. And so I thought there was a similarity, but I'll generally just like try to shy away from comparing to my other songs or like, have I already started a song in this D chord? I've started millions of songs with a D chord or formation, like maybe capoed up, but that's always feels like a very comfortable place to start. And I felt like that combo of those chords, yeah, it felt fresh to me. I hope it doesn't seem tired or overplayed.
Adding the articulation, so the fact that you have that pause at the end of it every time, that's this unique expression now. I think you said in your book, maybe I just have thought this many times myself, that when you're writing a song, you have to pretend that it's the first song ever written or something. You know, that's the only song in the world. Because otherwise, as you said, yeah, of course, we're reflecting our influences. And as you write more and more, you're sort of have worked out your style and are probably expressing something
right. That's
at least in a mode that you've expressed before. That type of story, the specific notion of has somebody used this metaphor, this image, you know, bangs as a shield against scrutiny and the world. I don't know. I come up with a lot of puns and anytime I think I've come up with something original, if you just Google it, like, no, there's probably a store. In fact, with that pun as a name,
right? Totally.
Metaphors, I think, are very similar that, yeah, of course it's got to be used, but it's the fact that you're telling a whole story. Of course it's going to be unique.
I remember that part in Girl to City was where I showed my friend Bob this song. Oh, and it goes, don't wake me up, I'm only sleeping. And he's like, oh, like the Beatles song. Oh, yeah, I guess so. I hadn't really thought about that, but it still felt like its own thing.
So you wrote this at the camp. When then did you record it? Was it years later? Was it still when it was very fresh?
The camp was before the pandemic, but I hadn't, this was the first time I've made an album, like a studio album since then. So I hoped I would record it. I think from the first time I played it, I knew I wanted to record it. So it was just, yeah, one of the songs that I had kind of set aside for when I was making an album in the studio.
And is the rest of the arrangement in terms of like the keyboard stuff and the lead guitar stuff, is that coming from your brain? Is that you turning over to Eric at some point? How is this actually coming together? The specific choice in like the wow, wow, you know, that particular riff.
I really love that. That was Eric's idea. And I really like that. We just kind of worked together. It kind of had the feel it had from the acoustic guitar. The drums are super simple. I love that little thing that Eric does. I wanted it to be kind of the type of story it is. It had to be a kind of, I don't want to say trashy, but certainly wasn't like, oh, an arrangement that had to be approached with respect for the song. And, you know, like, you know, there's nothing precious about it. It was like, we'll just have like a good time doing this.
I assume that, so the bridge, the same, it's very decorated with their sort of 16 note oboe synth. And
the bridge was like, it has to be, the bridge had to be a different kind of musical feeling. And that was kind of as if there was a string section or something almost symphonic. Eric had bought a new piece of equipment. I think it's called an Ensonic, like a little synthesizer. And so that got that little like build up part going. I can't remember if I played it or I think we both played different sections of it.
Right. Cause you got your synth flute sort of thing on top and then you got your 16th note oboe-ish sort of sound.
Exactly. Yeah. Tried to get some like backup type vocals in there, which was fun, and just kind of build it up like that.
So right after that, you have the same sort of break that you've had before, but with this crescendoing guitar thing, which sounds like it's getting louder and it's going to enter a solo, but it doesn't. It's just done. And then you're back on the next verse.
It's 10 years on, I'm chilling here, but I admit I should.
Was that, again, just sort of a Eric put something in, or was that something you dictated that you wanted it to have a certain feel?
I'm not meaning to sound like it just like happened without any planning, but the arrangement was always sort of there, just built in song. So it kind of had to drop back down again for that part because it's 10 years on, you know, so it's kind of, sure. To me, things like that are always kind of cinematic. And Eric, I think, often works the same way. There's more like long shots and then there's close-ups and then there's montages, you know, like just like a movie. So maybe that part you're talking about was sort of like a, you know, where and when you're watching an old film and they do that part where they show all these years going by just like throwing all these images on the screen of things that happened leading up to the time you're going to come back in. I would say like if we examined it that much, I would probably get really bored.
Right before we get to that section, it would have been perfectly legitimate, you know, you're finishing the bridge to just go into sort of a fast solo or something like that. But no, we're going to keep it simple.
I haven't got the time to fight. You say we ought to be together, but it ain't right.
Well, I guess it's the wow, wow serves as the solo, as the instrumental that's taking over that doesn't need a whole actual solo right there.
That's interesting because I was just talking to someone yesterday about Fountains of Wayne, and I don't know how familiar with that band you are, but one thing I really like about their records is they don't do all this grandstanding, showboating, like lead guitar, hot guitar player coming in, like screeching gratuitously. Mm-hmm. They have instrumental sections, but they don't do that. And I really like that. I feel like when I first started making solo records, I probably felt obliged to have a guitar. I always had a guitar player on stage with me. Now I don't. I play in a trio with Eric playing bass. And when I play with a band, I play solo a lot, but I play guitar myself. That moment where this other thing has to come in expressing itself, I don't feel that need for that on stage. And I guess I don't feel it on record either. I feel like sometimes you kind of want a part that's like an instrumental section that's kind of designed or expressive. But as for the convention of having to have like some player, like I almost feel like I've kind of heard enough of that, unless it's just something that really like goes and is really compelling and there feels like there needs to be a reason for it. Just doesn't really feel like it's my place to like have to provide that. So I don't know. I hope that that's not like a disappointment to a listener, but I kind of just want to stick to, in this song, I guess I felt like the story was more important and it didn't need like a moment for someone to like, someone being either Eric or I, like on the rest of the album, there are some solos. Sometimes they're me, sometimes they're him, sometimes it's both of us.
Well, and the fact that you and Eric, of course, are both singers, so that if you're going to do an instrumental section like the wham wham, it can be a singable. I prefer if the instruments are going to take over, at least as a singer, if I'm writing it, I will write a melody, not a let's work out what would Elliot Easton do here, which might be extremely melodic. He's like one of the most, I mentioned him just, will have mentioned in the intro that he produced your first couple albums. So of course, if you have him working on it, you're probably going to insert some solos, you know?
Definitely. And it was always kind of fun to see what he would come up with. He was super melodic player and bass player too. He played bass on those albums as well. But yeah, I guess the approach is different, more from a songwriting arranging point of view than a guitarist.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. My podcast brand is more or less founded on the idea of self-examination and its perils. And I'm guessing that you listeners also fancy yourselves pretty self-aware individuals, or at least you recognize that that is something to shoot for. So it's kind of ridiculous that I've never had any formal therapy. Anyone who's curious about what's going on in their heads might want to try it. In my case, either things have never seemed quite bad enough, or I just didn't want to make the effort to find a therapist, have to go there every week. So since I'm having to record these ads for BetterHelp, I have decided to give it a try. I've just gone through the application procedure, which is a brief questionnaire to get you matched with a licensed therapist. What do you want to get out of therapy? What do you think is wrong? And of course, there are no wrong answers. Just curious is an option. I know that with BetterHelp, if you don't mesh with your therapist, they will connect you with someone else very quickly at no additional cost. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. So whether you're just curious about therapy or you think, you know, I really should be diagnosed for some of the things that I do, you might want to join me in giving BetterHelp a try and let me know how it goes. Rediscover your curiosity with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/nakedly today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/nakedly.
Spring into gear at Bay Ridge Honda, your go-to Honda dealer serving the five boroughs of New York. All March long, drive home one of over 350 new Hondas for $0 down. Plus, make no payments for 90 days. And as always, get an extra $1,500 for your trade-in. Stay tuned for the new Honda Prologue at Bay Ridge Honda, in Brooklyn and online at bayridgehonda.com. $0 down payment and no payments for 90 days with approved credit for well-qualified buyers only. See dealer for details. It's 331-24.
Well, before we reach back to that era, let's talk about Genevieve's Bag from the 2012 album, A Working Museum, credited to both you and Eric together. And this one is even quite a bit more minimalist, although a very different feel, but it's got a sort of 50s, early 60s, some kind of this chord progression that you've heard, but it's one of those really emotionally nice ones. And it just gives you a nice palette to then have lyrics that, like the previous song, it's not like you have a chorus that repeats again and again. It's, we're just going to keep piling more lyrics on this. Yeah. Can you say a little about Genevieve's Bag and where you're at with this album before we hear the song?
Yeah, that was from A Working Museum, which was a Reckless Eric and Amy Rigby album. And it was the third one that we made together, the third album. And we had been living in France. We were just packing up to move to New York, to the US. And we kind of been working on an album in our studio in France, but that was all packed up. I just kind of wrote this song on the fly. We were staying at a friend's house and we recorded the demo right there, just like in his living room with what we had with us. It just was very immediate. It kind of feels almost more like a poem in a way. And it's kind of an interesting illustration following on from what we talked about with guitar playing with the previous track, because Eric plays this instrumental part over the chords at the end. And it always makes me cry. I find it very, very moving. It's just, if you don't follow it, you might even think it's like noise. But it's very, it builds and it has like so much emotion in it. Part of it is that tension of those chords and what, and also the lyrics that came before and the emotion of that. It also has like an extra bar, I think, at the end of each section so that the tension keeps on in that part. That is an instance where I feel like someone expressing themselves on guitar is, to me, it's really part of the record. And when we ever played it live, I always felt like it was such a high, like an emotional highlight of our show. It was the part you just couldn't talk about in the song. There weren't words to convey what the guitar did. There was too much to say at that point. And that's why just like all these cascading, bouncing notes were like, that was the reason for being there. It was a looking back kind of song, you know, looking back to being a parent back in New York. And we were heading back to New York at the time, not to the city. It was nostalgia, nostalgia in reverse and kind of nostalgia in advance for a place and a time. The phases of being a parent that are not that often expressed in songs, I don't think.
Blue rich plates, a hot pink shoelace, that old shot from Splash Mountain. Some music biz swag. Your Spice Girls mug and a Genovese bag.
Yeah, so not just that four chord progression, but that each of them is a double length. We're really stretching it out. Again, to sort of bring us back to that theme that we had before. Certainly this has been used in some particular, I'm picturing 50s, early 60s, whatever, but like, were you able to drive all that out of your head? Because it's a very compelling progression in itself.
I play the acoustic guitar and Eric played that do 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 do, which was, I think it's from this, was used a similar kind of figure in a record called, I think it's called White Horses. We'd seen it in this film that's called, like, I think it's called Me Without You. It's a British film about two teenage girls, and it just has a really great pop soundtrack. And I think they use one of Eric's songs, and I'm pretty sure that that was how it came to our attention. It's just really kind of like got a good style and a good use of music. And I think that that song was in that film. So that was kind of like, maybe we'd watched it pretty recently and that's where it like came like, oh, this would be good over that. So it did that. I loved that little motif that he played and it kind of gave it a nostalgic feeling already, kind of childlike and girlish. I felt like that went really well.
Yeah, I feel like I need to contradict pretending that no songs have ever been written before. In fact, there are times that I've written songs because I'm listening to another song and I'm enjoying it. I'm sort of wanting to sing along. And so I sort of write new lyrics sort of with that melody, but then I change it later, you know, so that it's its own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, you know, that you're joining in the world of music or whatever. This is part of what makes it enjoyable is that it's not you starting from scratch, that it is actually, as you talk about in your book lots of times, that you were so inspired by these country artists. Yeah, so this kind of nostalgic entering into given that the lyrics are so personal and so direct, you know, compared to the other one, which was, you know, a constructed involving your real life and things, but a constructed situation, whereas this could just be, you know, something that's in a letter, having that juxtaposed with something that is not, that is just the paper that's lying around, let's say.
It kind of grounds it in the, like, in the universal. And also, so that sets it up. And it is great about songwriting that you can pick the most specific personal details and they actually resonate with people more than if you said, like, you know, the trees and flowers. And, you know, like if you really zero in on a detail, it can unleash something in somebody else's memory about their own life. But it I think it does help to kind of pin it on. You do a little work for the listener and give them some kind of mood or motif that they can get them started, like feeling like, oh, this makes me feel kind of sad and kind of like I'm watching a merry-go-round or like a little toy. I don't know, sort of like a little lullaby song or something. And so that definitely does that in there.
Well, and lyrically, you're mixing flesh and blood, rag and bone, kith and kin, you know, these sort of nice sounding, I don't want to say cliches, but the sayings or whatever, you know, quotations, you know, they apply as opposed to near the donut shop with the old fashioned cup holders that you're going to zoom right in and give a concrete detail of, you know, the actual scene, and mixing those two things together, I thought was an interesting, when exactly you made the transition between those.
I think from listening to a lot of Bob Dylan, he'll use like a string of cliches, you know, like phrases that are kind of stock, but it's the way he puts them together. You don't have to be original every second. It kind of sets things up. You lay some of the groundwork for the person who's listening to feel like they feel at ease and they feel like they know what you're talking about. And then you can maybe like make them work a little harder.
I'd almost felt when the tension really starts ratcheting up on the verses here, it seemed like a bridge. That's how usually I put that sort of pattern in a bridge, whereas maybe the verse is a little more calm. Maybe you have a chorus. I mean, this could have had and your Genovese bag, you know, you could have written some kind of chorus. I'm not saying it needs that, but yeah, what was your thought in just that this ends up being sort of a list? I mean, it is kind of like a Bob Dylan song.
You know, and I guess it's probably goes back to some old, you know, blues tradition. I don't know what they call that, the refrain, where you just, everything leads up to that one line that's kind of like, oh, this was what all that was about. And that it just, it really was not a conscious thing. It was really just the, I guess, you know, the emotion kind of builds. And it's not really much of a melody even. It's very linear, but when it goes up even one note, it like has an impact. And a lot of times with things like this, they're not conscious for me at all. It just kind of comes out that way. I mean, sometimes I will shape a melody more, but generally, if I'm telling a story, I just let it dictate where that's going to do, what the melody is going to do. And it's not even till afterwards where I'm going like, oh, it felt like it really like went up high here, but it actually just like went up a full step. That's all, you know, it didn't like jump up. It just kind of rose to the note above. But it felt like consequential. And maybe that's because of the repeating chords underneath or something. The vowel sounds and, you know, the words that you're actually singing the notes over can really have like such an emotional impact. So many times, like certain words, certain lines, they'll just like make me want to cry. It's like that when I write something in my blog too. You know, I just wrote one today about moving and how my daughter, like, we said goodbye to her and she had our trash in the back of my Subaru. Just saying that right now, I feel like crying. I don't know why. It's just that combination of those two things. And that image, I guess, feels so poignant to me. It's like that with songs. And so when I get that misty feeling, I don't really question it or try to, you know, amplify it or labor it or, you know, make it more, you know, I just kind of trust that like something happened there that like moved me and hopefully like a listener would someone else listening would feel that same thing, that I would communicate that to them.
Yeah, I could see how the repetition, again, sort of like using that progression, but it gives you a pattern, you know, something to fit then these personal sentiments into, as opposed to just writing them freehand. Filling out a birthday card, you know, where you feel the need, or an anniversary card, to fill up a good amount of the blank space is always challenging, you know, because I've done it for my wife 20, 30, you know, many times. So having a pattern to, you know, to fit, right? Even if it's like Dr. Seuss rhymes or whatever, like I like...
I love the pattern. It's like having to solve an equation. And yeah, there is something very satisfying and comforting about having this pattern that you are going to adhere to. And that kind of creates this freedom within the framework to say, you know, to go where the sentiment wants to go.
And I don't know if this was intentional, but when you get to, so I phone on a phone and sometimes you phone, you know, of course it is a very relatable sentiment for anybody like me that has kids that have gone off to college or whatever, but it's almost like the repetition within that line is sort of making a joke about the repetition of the line after line that's been going, at least that, you know, suggested that. That also kind of plays into, you talked about how really this is a 2.5 minute song, but then it stops, the story stops, but the guitar picks it up saying more than you can say, but is starting in a very slowly repetitive way, very much like that crescendoing note in the previous song that I said, oh, why is there not a solo here? Is this supposed to go into a solo? Well, this is one where it sort of does that, but it actually becomes a solo, but it still never becomes like, it becomes a Lindsey Buckingham solo. It becomes a, I'm playing one note or one riff and really just feeling that. And do you know, at the end, did he add an extra guitar or was there a looper pedal? Do you have any idea? Because there's definitely more than one thing going on by the end. I didn't know if it was just delay effect that had been turned on or whether there was more than one lead guitar playing.
You know, I can't remember.
Okay. That's all right. At some point, you just can't even express it with one layer. It has to be a tumbling jumble.
But I love that about, you know, like with writing to not just songs, but how you can, and films too, like you can do the whole montage thing, or you can just jump to the next part and just assume that people will. I guess this is going back to Bricks a little bit, like how you can just like jump ahead and just assume like people will catch up with where you're at. I guess this is just kind of like playing on into the future. I imagine there's like another guitar comes in there. But the thing is, maybe not, because when we've played it live, it sounds very and feels very similar. So maybe there's a little bit of a pedal in there.
Are there any verses that were removed from this? Like I could see it narratively makes sense for the guitar just to take over and just, okay. But it also would make sense to have it do that for a while. And now we're going to have a final verse or something, you know. Was there any thought, this is just how it was written? And
no, this was how, in fact, I have the piece of paper that I wrote it on. And then this was like a longhand one, because I didn't have a printer hooked up anymore. So, because we were in the middle of moving, and it did feel like finality that the last verse says, you know, I unpacked a box from the storage space. So it was like kind of bringing it into the now, like there were Blue Ridge plates, the hot pink shoelace, you know, so it was like taking the artifacts of the past and kind of revisiting the past through looking at the things that I've brought from the past into the present. And yeah, so that was it. I mean, I definitely got songs where I ended up cutting verses out of the recorded version. This wasn't one of them. In fact, it's been a while since I did that. Back in the last Roundup days, there were definitely a few of those. And I remember on Diary of a Mod Housewife, there's a song called Sad Tale. And I remember talking with Elliot Easton about this particular verse and him saying, like, this is a good part for an instrumental to come in. And, you know, just like right there on the spot going like, yeah, I guess that verse could go, you know. I thought it was a brilliant thing that he played there. I love that instrumental. But, you know, every now and then, like maybe I have a demo of the song and I was like, that was a good verse. I really felt like it made the song kind of made more sense with it. But as time has gone on, I think songs have gotten a lot shorter. And sometimes I can't believe, just in general, people's attention span is shorter. Younger bands make much shorter songs and often like only have like one verse. Things don't even repeat, you know, like a chorus doesn't even necessarily have to repeat. And I think we don't want to be like stuck in the past, like, you know, just like being too literal and having to like flesh things out too much. I think it's almost better to be briefer nowadays.
I mean, there's the question of length, which of course, this is a pretty long song that we, with the guitar, but also just how much you're rethinking things. And especially when you're working in a group and you're playing it on stage again and again, and maybe in a group situation where other people feel confident that they might know, or, you know, a producer or somebody might be able to improve, to hone, to find the nugget and really emphasize that. And that can really produce something good, but it also feels just great to be free about it and put it down. And now it's done. And it's not necessarily something that you were more satisfied with the thing that got rethought 10 times with four other people contributing. That might have made it more marketable or something, but if that's not the point.
I guess it's probably been a long time since I worried about that. That was probably like back in the 90s was the last time I worried too much about whether. I've definitely had times where I kind of said, well, I wish I didn't say fuck in that song, you know, or another swear word, you know, like shit or fuck, because that's going to keep someone, you know, who might like want to play it on their non-commercial radio show, but they can't. So I guess that's about as much as I've worried about anything that might put somebody off or, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if anybody does, do people still worry about whether, I'm sure there's some rarefied like music business that committees are contriving to make things more saleable, but I don't feel like that's my world at all. So
sure. Yes. More saleable, or just like, I want to express the pure pop nugget of this thing. I don't know. I've definitely had some things that, whether it's other people contributing or me returning to it multiple times to just really try to pound this into a diamond as opposed to just letting it be an expression. Well, let's, with that in mind, turn to the third song, Beer and Kisses, from Diary of a Mod Housewife, 1997, your first solo album featuring, I didn't recognize his voice, but I've had Wesley Stace, a.k.a. John Wesley Harding, on this show before, recently, actually. He's singing an American accent on this. You had mentioned in your book that people were thinking, oh, this could be a big radio hit. It does seem to like really distill something that you had gotten from your love of country music. Can you say a little about it before we hear it?
Yeah, Beer and Kisses. I think it's kind of an interesting song structure, which I wasn't conscious. It just came out that way. Like I wrote a verse and then the chorus was more like a refrain, I guess. I like with country songs how they'll change like a few words to change each time it comes back around. You change a little phrase here or there so it means something different, adds something new to the story. It just felt like a short story fiction version of my real life. And I remember the first time I played it live, I was at this strange, it was in a mill like near New Hope, Pennsylvania, almost like a house concert, but it was in this kind of rustic setting, played it just solo. And I felt like I didn't feel like anybody particularly noticed or cared about that song. It felt like it didn't really go over that great. And I just remember thinking like, you know, I know that that's like a good song. And then, you know, maybe I'm not presenting it right. Then I worked it up with a kind of a funny combo that was like, I think I had a violin player and another singer. And I don't even know if we had drums, but I just like was doing a couple gigs with this kind of configuration of a couple other women. And I thought we did a kind of a cool version of it. And I felt like it was getting a little more, people were noticing it more and going like, oh, that was, you know, a cool song. But it just kind of, when I went to record with Elliot Easton, he kind of introduced that Suspicious Minds kind of guitar part that's like the figure in there. And then as we were recording, at the studio, I said, like, I think it should be a duet. You know, no one like from the label or something said it should be. I just thought that it made sense, and it kind of felt like it cried out for this other texture. And just so happened to notice, and back then it was sort of pre-internet even, like I noticed in the Weekly in Los Angeles that John Wesley Harding was doing an in-store at some place in LA. And I was like, oh, I kind of met him, you know, back with the Shams. I don't really know him, but, you know, maybe I should get in touch with him and see if he could do it. He has a nice, warm kind of human, you know, just like approachable voice. And yeah, so I went and drove to his hotel. We ran through the song, then drove him over to the studio. It wasn't an easy harmony to come up with. Like, he did a good job, I thought, like, I'm kind of weaving in there. And now as the years have gone by, it's still one of people's favorite songs of mine. And I still always, I loved it. It still brings the emotion for me. It just really like chokes me up. I've kind of long dropped the Suspicious Mind guitar part. I kind of feel like it's extraneous. I always felt like it was more like an early country music song, like back to the 20s, back to like the Carter Family, or I felt it was more like a primitive song and not a kind of honky tonk or sort of rock and country song. And that's how I tend to approach it when I play it solo, more like one of those droney Carter Family or Delmore Brothers, or, you know, so just kind of think of it like super simple, not with these big drums and stuff. And I just let the song kind of do its thing.
Met in the supermarket, we loved like it was something new. From day one, we could not be parted. You had me, and honey, I had you. We got a little place between us, not much, but we could call it home. We lived on beer and kisses, all hopped up on love and foam. Get home from work, turn on the lights, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there. Get home from work, turn on the lights, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there. We grew couch potato. You said she looked just like me, but something had come between us. Beer and kisses didn't flow so free. At night you were tired from working. You thought all I did was play. You drank your beer in the kitchen. I'd sit on the couch and pray. Get home from work, get in a fight, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there. Get home from work, get in a fight, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there. My dear, I have much to tell you. It's sad how we both forget the thing we had for each other way back when we first met. Let's put all the bad behind us tonight when you come home. Just bring me beer and kisses. We'll get high on love and work, make it all right, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there. Get home from work, make it all right, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there.
I'd picked this one because you had talked a lot in your book about reflecting back some of the stuff you were hearing in country music and how you could make country music, how you saw it as just as personal as punk, and you could express yourself through this. I mean, maybe this is like what we were talking about with the 50s thing of giving yourself a slot. But here, it's not just a musical pattern or something. It is beer and kisses. Like, it sounds like a country song. You know, you're not talking about the lights in Texas or anything like that, but there are definite tropes that you're drawing on a little bit here. Yeah. Can you say a little about your evolving relationship with country music and how it manifested in this song?
Well, Beer and Kisses, the title came from my daughter was like 6 or 7, and she brought home portraits of her dad and me from school. And mine was called Kisses, and her dad's said beer on it.
Okay.
That was where the title came from. And yeah, and I just thought that was such a clever juxtaposition of these things. And it did kind of go with the whole my love of country music. I think it was how I started writing songs, because I felt it was approachable to me in a way that the punk music that I'd really loved had never been. I just felt like the kind of humble subject matter of country music, you know, it just spoke to me and felt like something that I could contribute to. I liked that it was also like, you know, because I lived in an apartment in New York City and you could be quiet and writing it. Unlike, you didn't need volume to do it. You could just do it quietly over an acoustic guitar. I liked the simple chords and yeah, just the way it told a story.
Well, you got that, what sounds like it might be, even though, as you just said, it was actually completely personal, but it's part of what sells it as a country song, the beer and kisses, but then following it up with hopped up on love and foam or getting high on love and foam, that is just a purely original image. Combining those elements, I guess part of the country music thing is also sort of the 9 to 5, right? The working person, what's being reflected in this, which is, you know, as you said in your autobiography, is completely the dynamic of being worn out from working. And as you talk about in other songs, the minutiae of having to, what you need to do to be a parent, but how the weight of our daily activities on us. Any further thought about sort of how you're channeling the universal versus saying just, this is just what happened to me?
I think, yeah, like with a lot of songs I've written, some of the experiences might be from my personal experience, but I usually picture other characters as I'm writing the song. I'm just picturing like other characters on this movie screen sort of in my mind. I just feel like I'm projecting my own truth or whatever you want to call it onto just these general characters that aren't me, but and hopefully that helps them translate to other people.
Well, like you said, that you just change a couple words and it changed the meaning of the whole chorus, right? We've sort of seen in the previous songs we've talked about that you're not big on, let's have a chorus that just repeats itself. So the fact that you have that, but you still have those tweaks so you can keep telling the story, and that you construct it as, what a wonderful thing, being at home and sitting on the couch is great. Oh, wait, but being weighed down by the world, not so good. And then, but then you throw in the sort of return, at least temporary return to happiness. Maybe this point at an eternal cycle of going between bickering and comfort. And then, yeah, just your choice on how you're going to end it. Bring me beer and kiss it. And you're just repeating that over and over again. Again, you didn't do that in Genevieve's Bag. Is that just that this seemed like a very singable song? Let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, the word beer, I guess, maybe lends itself to being held out or sung more than, yeah, like Genevieve's Bag is not exactly, that's more like of a spoken phrase. Also, another thing about this song, the whole couch thing, couches were just always, have been such a, like a hot topic. And I don't know if it was from living in the city or something, but I never felt like I had a good couch, you know, and maybe it was from just being broke, you know, and trying to have a couch was like, you know, getting it up 4 flights of stairs. I was working this job and it was, you know, for a real estate company. And one of my bosses was like, oh, I have this really, you know, like, would you like my couch? I'm getting a new one. And I'll send the crew, you know, because they've employed all these maintenance guys, like, we'll send them over in a van with this couch for you. And so, like, for the first time, I actually felt like we had a couch. So that was, like, really, like, such a major moment in my life. So it's something that, like, it's just kind of embedded in the past. Like, I don't even think about it that much, but that was really probably why it was all centered around this couch. You know, a lot of times things like this are not conscious at all. They're just really kind of, like, so ingrained in, like, day-to-day life that they come out in a very, like, powerful way as a symbol. Without even being a symbol, it's totally literal, like, we've got a couch. I think it was just the style of the song did just sort of lend itself to riding out over the refrain, because it was seemed like such a memorable phrase. So that was why, I guess, that seemed like it made sense to do that.
I guess any thought on making it a duet, but yet, and you say this, I need him to play the husband, and you're describing this in your book, but yet you don't pass it, like, so he takes a verse or anything like that. That was not the particular piece of theater that you were choosing.
It didn't seem like it was two voices talking to each other, that it kind of, it was as much for just the texture. And so technically, I don't think it really is a duet.
A question relating to all these, but also your book. So you're very vivid about locations and props and things. Like, I feel like I know of every apartment that you ever lived in, and, you know, what you would see when you walk out the door. Characters, not so much. I found I still don't actually know the difference between your two fellow shams after reading that whole book at such length, that there's not a lot of, I mean, is that related to just, you're talking about real people, and so you're not gonna, it just feels weird that somebody might read this and you're trying to characterize their personality. Instead, you're just saying, you know, Will had curly hair, and this is the kind of stuff we would do together. We would listen to records together, not like some sort of analysis. Or is this something about that you don't do that in songs either? You don't describe in detail somebody, a third party's habits and mental state and things like that. You're more about, let me describe the concrete things around me and images like that, not she was a contemplative girl with, you know, or whatever.
That's interesting, Mark. I hadn't really thought about that, but I think that's very true. I mean, I guess I, you know, all I can really think I said was that Amanda was statuesque.
Somebody had an in on, you know, getting us better hairstyles or whatever, you know, logistical stuff.
Yeah, she was the style kind of statuesque one. And Sue had, you know, paint spattered clothes because she painted apartments. But it's true. I don't think I went into much like character analysis. And that's a good observation. I'm kind of trying to think, well, gosh, is that some sort of like defect of my own personality, like a kind of feeling like I'm an island, you know?
I just was wondering if that was, if you felt like that was a thing in your songs as well, or whether this is just something specific to writing a biography that is about real people. So you're just not gonna.
It could be the same in the songs, you know? I don't try to like reflect other people's experiences because sure. I don't feel like that's my story to tell. Maybe part of it is from being a mother, like being very conscious of, especially now that my daughter's like an adult, like being very conscious of not wanting to betray
sure.
her confidence in me and like not wanting to, same with my brothers, you know, not feeling like I had a right to tell their story. And so probably same with friends and husbands, loved ones, you know. That's an interesting something to think about.
Well, and it probably does apply much more to prose than to songs. I'm trying to just think, like, there are not that many songs that are like a character study of another person. Like, they're usually personal expressions or you know, there are many, many things that they can do. But
I have a song on the old guys called Bob. It's my experience of Bob, but it's also, you know, has some details about him in it. And I still don't know how he feels about that song. I've asked him. But yeah, I'm going to be like thinking about that.
Well, let's stop here by just introducing a final tune. What is listed on Spotify as your most listened to track right now, Dancing with Joey Ramone from Little Fugitive, 2005. This is another scene that's in the book. That's a pivotal moment. I mean, if this is what you're talking about, of sort of going to CBGBs in early time and experiencing the Ramones, and this sort of entranced you, you know, seduced you, at least a different aspect or a different level of engagement with music?
The song actually was written way later when I lived in Nashville. Then Joey had died, and I dreamt this whole thing where I, exactly as the song says, he walked into the party looking just like he had. And I just kind of woke up in the morning and transcribed exactly what I had seen in my dream. But it really did kind of capture this feeling of a fandom that I had, and also just that he would have been like such a great friend and person to hang, and I never knew him, but you know, it would have been just so cool to hang out with him.
Well, thanks so much for doing this last song, and the Bjorn Kisses, and so much of the other stuff is just so fun, yet without compromising literary ambition, you know, vivid storytelling and stuff. So it was really, really a pleasure spending time with your work.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks a lot. I've really enjoyed talking through it all.
All right, here it is, Dancing with Joey Ramone.
He walked into the party looking just like he had in the past. He came up to me and he didn't even have to ask. I tried to say something, he said, girl, shut your mouth. You're playing Papa was a Rolling Stone. Last night I was dancing with Joey Ramone. Leather jacket and his little dark shades. He started dancing around. I tried to copy every move he made. When I reached for his hand, he kind of brushed me off. And they played Hanging on the Telephone. Last night when I was dancing with Joey Ramone, they played the worst that could happen. The Brooklyn Bridge, he hit me and it felt like a kiss. Glad all over, needles and pens. Be my baby again and again. Gloria by the shadows of night. He's so fine and I feel alright. Charlie Brown, can't sit down. We were dancing around.
Thanks so much to Amy. She mourned a bit in her book how when she was coming up, women were not typically seen as like the Bob Dylan literary singer-songwriter type, and I think she fits that description very well. You can get more of her work at amyrigby.com. And again, go look up the podcast Girl to City, though I'll warn you that that has much more about just what it was like to be in New York City in the early 80s. And witness the punk scene, then her musical journey, which she gets into in the last several episodes of the podcast, and is pretty much done by the time we hit her second or third solo album. But I really enjoyed that as part of a way to prepare for this. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or look up Nakedly Examined Music on Apple Podcasts or wherever. Make sure you're subscribed directly to this feed. My upcoming episodes are with Dale Crover from The Melvins, And then I just today recorded with Steve Dawson. He was with a band called Dolly Varden out of Chicago for a while and is now a solo artist in the sort of country rock, but with some R&B and other stuff. Very sharp guy, very good songwriter. And I've got some amazing artists on the docket who I never want to actually announce before I interview them for fear of something going wrong. I hope you're all doing well, being creative. My band, currently called Manifest Lint, had a bit of a setback. It was an 8-piece when we recorded our live demo back in March or so. People can get that at marklint.bandcamp.com. Right after that, we shrank to a 7-piece, which was fine. But now we're down a bass player, so I've switched over to bass, at least temporarily, until we find somebody else from guitar. So the road to actually recording the album with them that I have long since written all the songs for just seems longer and longer stretching out before me. We're also trying to learn a lot of covers so we can play a greater variety of places. And that in itself is contentious. What is our style? What covers should we be doing? Are we having as much fun? Are we being as maximally appealing as we should be? It's interesting to think about Amy's disdain at this point for any sort of commercial appeal or record company approval, as she described it, when I am at this late point in life still trying to put together a set that maybe has wider appeal than my personal sensibilities, my originals, would support. All right, done oversharing there. Although if I do have any listeners in the Madison area who are or might be able to put me in touch with some new replacement musicians, feel free to reach out to me, or feel free to reach out to me just about the show, about what guests I should have on the show. Maybe you're a guest, you want to put yourself forward. mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. You can also follow the podcast on Facebook, on Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter. And I must, as always, push our Patreon, patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I would really, really, really appreciate your support if you are a steady listener to the show. The ads for these do not make very much money. And your support really helps to know that I should continue to do this. And the Patreon is set up so you only pay if I actually put out episodes. But if your dollars are stretched thin, I would say always try to put some of them in the pockets of the guests that I have on the show. Especially, you might want to use Bandcamp. Gives a lot more of the money to the artist. They've started Bandcamp Fridays again, where Bandcamp doesn't take any cut at all. So try to get out and see some of these folks or pick up their CDs or just put a little money in the kitty somehow rather than just listening on Spotify where they will receive, you know, 1 cent, if that. All right, enough lecturing. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep on musicin'. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer signing off.
Hey moms, looking for some lighthearted guidance on this crazy journey we call parenting?
Join me, Sabrina Kohlberg.
And me, Andy Mitchell, for Pop Culture Moms,
where each week we talk about what we're watching
and examine our favorite pop culture moms up close to try to pick up some parenting hacks along the way.
Come laugh, learn, and grow with us as we look for the best tips
and maybe a few what not to do's from our favorite fictional moms.
From Good Morning America and ABC Audio,
Pop Culture Moms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.